theoretically, you could take a 20-gene panel and potentially submit over a million different ways. So the problem with billing is it's not transparent. It's also not clear-cut. X number of people had mutations in these genes we wouldn't have known had we not done this panel. It's not telling us beyond that how we should manage those patients. What are the interventions that are going to reduce morbidity and mortality?
Welcome to GenotypeCast, a new podcast from Gray Genetics. Genetics isn't always black and white. News stories related to genetics often raise more questions than they answer. On GenotypeCast, we bring you insight from genetic counselors. I'm your host, Eleanor Griffith, a certified genetic counselor and the founder of Gray Genetics, an independent telehealth genetic counseling and consulting service. Kate Wilson received her master's in genetic counseling from the University of South Carolina. She worked as a clinical genetic counselor in Houston for over 6 years in both prenatal and cancer genetics, establishing and coordinating several cancer genetic counseling services. She was faculty for the UT Medical School and worked for the University of Texas Genetic Counseling Program. For the past 6 years, she has worked for Quest Diagnostics, where she is currently a product manager in oncology. She is actively involved in the National Society of Genetic Counselors, is the former chair of the Access and Service Delivery Committee and the Education Committee, and is the current co-host of the NSGC podcast series. She will start a term on the ABGC Board of Directors in 2020. So you've been a genetic counselor for about 12 years, and half of that in clinical roles and half in a laboratory. So I think you have a pretty good and I think broad perspective on how panels have come into testing, especially for cancer, but also in other areas, and just like also the lab side of that when it comes to coverage and insurance coverage for things.
Yes, I would say it's, I appreciate that I can see it from multiple viewpoints, because I think, you know, billing for lab testing is a challenge, and sometimes it can be really frustrating to see what is covered and what isn't covered. But then also working on the lab side and helping understand a bit more about coding and how to work and speak with insurance companies, that has been very helpful to see kind of that part of the conversation as well.
Yeah. And there's, I mean, initially when we started talking about this topic, we were talking about how there's always papers coming out, or at least like posters, labs will always have posters saying like, look how many more mutations we found with a bigger panel, which, you know, when you test more genes, you do find more things.
Right.
So then I feel like that's kind of been the trend, is we tend to order bigger panels, but like, what do you see are the problems and the challenges that come up with that in terms of it, both insurance billing and just like patient management and how helpful this information actually is?
Right. So I think that's the thing, is they're getting bigger. We're able to test for more. And the technology we have allows us to do that. And, you know, we're being able to find that a lot of our, you know, traditional, I guess, clinical phenotype doesn't always necessarily fit the genotype that we're getting. The challenge is that the panels have expanded to the point where we're including, you know, emerging or not really well understood genes. And, you know, initially they were on some of these panels, and then people are ordering the testing, asking for insurance to pay for genes that haven't really had the evidence or the outcome data to show that by identifying mutations in this gene, I am reducing the morbidity and mortality of my patient. And I think that's always the challenge with genetics. And I talk about it, you know, in terms of oncology, because that's the area I specialize in. But it's hard to get those long-term outcomes and evidence that insurance is asking for, that they need to be able to say, okay, this test truly is not just going to change medical management, but, you know, increase life expectancy, increase quality of life. There are proven interventions once we found this mutation that we know are going to make a difference. And right now, you know, we're seeing larger panels come out, but we still have a lot of low to moderate penetrant genes, you know, where you might have two times the risk of breast cancer, but we haven't necessarily shown that those patients need, you know, regular breast MRIs or would benefit from prophylactic mastectomy. I think as genetic counselors, we want to make sure we're giving our patients as much information and all the options. But the challenge is you know, then if we're ordering tests where there's not proven evidence or outcomes to insurance companies, it's not surprising that insurances may deny some of these tests.
Yeah. And I mean, is it true? I don't know. I feel like when panel testing was new, at least, like often what would happen is a lab would be billing for, let's say, BRCA testing, and then they just throw on the other genes, but they're not necessarily able to bill for those. And then I know some labs have stacked codes and tried to bill for those, but I think sometimes the attitude is like, well, why not? Like, as long as you're running a panel, why not put those genes on there? But how does that work from the billing end of things?
And that's a good question. So the problem with billing is it's not transparent. It's also not clear cut. There are multiple ways to bill for a panel. Like you mentioned, sometimes people will do what's called covered components. So that means, you know, you might run a panel of 30 plus genes, but we only know that BRCA is widely recognized or covered. So then the lab may bill just for the BRCA testing and not the other genes. Some do what's called, not necessarily stacking, but maybe like a tier coding or individual CPT coding. Most genes have their own individual CPT code. They may even have one for sequencing and one for deletion duplication. So if you're billing every CPT code that you test, you know, for, again, using like a 30 gene panel, theoretically, you could have somewhere around 60 different CPT codes potentially. Mm-hmm. The other the AMA has created is what's called GSP for genomic panels. So these are really designed for panel testing. In the realm of oncology, hereditary oncology, there's one for breast panels, one for colon panels. And what they do is they basically say, okay, you have to have a minimum of whatever, 10x number of genes. And some of those genes are specific genes. So they have to include like BRCA1 and 2 plus a few other genes. And as long as you meet this bare minimum requirement, you can bill this GSP code. Mm-hmm. That's been more of a challenge for labs to adopt because a lot of insurance companies don't recognize GSP. They may not be aware of them. So you have coding that changes to then adapt to the technology that's already being used. And then you have insurances trying to adapt to that coding. And the challenge for insurance is, there was a Concert Genetics does a good job kind of keeping up with all the CPT and the coding. And they recently came out saying, you know, that there's over 74,000 tests on the market or genetic tests on the market. Something like 9,500 right now are panel tests. And since you can bill in various ways and it's not always transparent how a lab is billing, theoretically, you could take a 20 gene panel and potentially submit over a million different ways to get reimbursed for that panel. So it's a lot to keep up with, and it's a challenge for insurance companies. It's a challenge for labs too to stay current with what's recommended. You have CMS that will make certain recommendations, but for like Medicare, but of course that only applies to patients that are actually affected or diagnosed with cancer. It doesn't necessarily tell us what, you know, give guidance on what should be billed when it's seen as a preventative service.
I remember the first when I was new to working in cancer genetics, especially in before I was at a public hospital and it was all like Medicaid mm-hmm. and charity care and then with private insurance and a phone call from a patient who'd seen like a previous genetic counselor there, just like distraught over the $19,000, what she thought was a bill that she'd received. And, you know, of course it was an EOB, mm-hmm. mm-hmm. But just it's so common for patients to see these EOBs with these like huge amounts on there.
Yeah. And that's unfortunate when that happens, because I think it does panic patients, and I completely understand, you know, then I think the challenge is you try to say it's an EOB. It doesn't necessarily, you know, it's not a bill. You're not going to have to pay it. And that can be reassuring to some, but to others, not so much. And then I think for me, what I come back to is if we're genetic counselors and we are being good stewards of responsible genomic testing, how does it look if the testing service I'm using is potentially, you know, charging something to an insurance company that seems way out of line? And that's a concern. Right. And there are some plans, I don't know how many nowadays, but some may have max lifetime amounts. And so again, it's one of those things where, yes, you know, the patient shouldn't owe that, and it's not, they're not obligated to pay an EOB, but you have to look at the overall spending of healthcare dollars and what is this doing to the overall healthcare system.
Yeah, and it's, I imagine it's still something that might, in a bigger sense, create more insurance barriers for patients who need testing, because labs, because an insurer could just be like, well, we're not going to cover this test. Like, this is ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's what we're seeing, is we're seeing the pushback, right, of potentially people either ordering more testing than was necessarily needed. You see insurance, you know, not wanting to pay for new or emerging genes, or low, you know, low yield genes, because to them, those are still research is needed. And, you know, the job of insurance is not necessarily to pay for somebody's research. I think, you know, we're seeing that too, because they put in, some of them have portals or things in place to, make sure they know who's pre-authorizing it or require pre-test genetic counseling. But then we see some labs that are trying to increase access for genetic testing, you know, by lowering the cost, which I think is good, you know, that we're trying to increase access. But I still feel conflicted, because I want insurance to be held accountable, and I want them to pay for the patients that they should be paying for. And I'm glad that there's this option for some folks, but there's still quite a few folks that can't even afford any out-of-pocket that really need testing and should be having the insurance that they already pay for covering the testing that they need.
Right.
So I like that there's options now, but I do worry that sometimes, you know, insurance isn't being either not necessarily held accountable, but we're not necessarily engaging or educating insurance as much as we should. It's now becoming a little bit easier to say, well, we'll just go outside of the insurance system, which isn't always the best system. Healthcare isn't always the greatest in the U.S., but it's the system we have to work with. And I would like to see more education and more engagement and collaboration with the insurance companies to get them to understand some of the coding, and enable them to be able, you know, to cover the patients that need it and to get testing to the patients that need it.
Yeah. Do you see those changes happening, like from where you sit, like over the next 5-10 years, like how do you see this changing? Do you think that the coding will become more streamlined, less complicated, that there'll be some consensus over what sort of tests insurance should really cover and what really should be research or self-pay?
I do see insurance companies becoming more aware of like panel coding. So the challenge is, again, with the panel codes, it's a bare minimum. So it doesn't still tell you everything that's being done. So there's still that challenge of transparency. So, you know, the lab being able to communicate what testing was and was not done to the insurance company so that the insurance company knows, you know, exactly what they're paying for. And that's always, I think, going to be a challenge because there's so many different panel products on the market. There are some potential, you know, codes where you can maybe either apply for them, labs could apply for them and in essence define what the code is for. I think we will start to see more insurance coverage of panel coding. But I do think we're still going to have that question of, you know, should some of these genes be offered as part of panel testing or not? And then the conversation may shift to, okay, we might recognize these panel codes, but now I have a patient, who has, you know, a mutation or something in, a less understood gene, like an XRCC2 or an MRE11A. And then it's still just, you're back to where you are with the insurance. Like, you know, am I supposed to be covering additional management? And then what am I telling my patient? So I still think people are going to be getting those types of results, but I think, you know, it has to be a conversation between clinicians, labs, and insurance companies, as well as professional societies, to figure out what's the best way to be transparent in panel testing and what genes really are needed from an evidence and outcome, base. Because I think that's the thing that, again, we're missing. There's a lot of articles talking about, you know, we did this large panel or we did this increased panel and it showed, you know, X number of people had mutations in these genes we wouldn't have known had we not done this panel. But again, it's kind of saying, okay, well, that's good. That information tells me that we've identified, you know, these mutations, but what else does it tell us? And it's not telling us beyond that, how we should manage those patients. What are the interventions that are going to reduce morbidity and mortality? And so my hope is that there'll be a shift of research from we're now identifying people to we've identified people, now what do we do with them? And now what do we offer them?
Do you think there's like funding for that research? Like when it comes from, like you were saying, like it's not insurance's job to cover mm-hmm. research, mm-hmm. but then, you know, with those, the large panels, I think often labs are like, oh, well, we learn a little bit. And genetic counselors are like, oh, we learn a little bit. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, like in the absence of that obvious, like long-term study where we're going to get that,
right,
figure out that potential utility, even as like in the meantime, there's all those downstream costs that potentially pile up.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's potential there to do those long-term studies. And again, I think, you know, at this point, it may end up being a partnership between labs and academia or labs and clinics, because, you know, labs can do the initial testing, but of course they don't follow these patients throughout their life or their treatment. And so that's where either the clinic or even a hospital system or a community type of hospital setting comes into play, where they're getting their care and can be followed long term. I think the challenge is you have labs now that are having partnerships with pharma, which I think, again, is fantastic and is going to help develop treatments for people who already have cancer. But the challenge is, how do we partner with people that can support the research that's going to prevent cancer, or that's going to look at interventions to reduce the risk of getting cancer? And again, I think that's, you know, the academic centers, the hospital systems, they're the ones that are going to have that data, but they may need additional financing, and that could potentially come from a lab or elsewhere.
Right. And in the meantime, like for a physician or a genetic counselor who's listening, or just a patient who's looking into testing options and like thinking about insurance, is there any advice you have for things that people should keep in mind that maybe they wouldn't necessarily?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I would say if you have health insurance, I do try to go through them. The coverage is actually better than it used to be. So I would not just assume that insurance is not going to pay for it. I think the other is, with whatever your lab you're sending your testing to, and they're billing insurance, they should be able to tell you what coding they're using to bill for that. So whether it's CPT codes, multiple CPT codes, or that GSP code, the lab that you're ordering testing through needs to be able to tell you what kind of coding they're submitting to the insurance company. And you need to know the ICD-10, so that's the diagnosis, as well. And so you can also, you know, reach out to the insurance companies to see what their coverage policies are. Some are more transparent than others. The other thing I would just say is, if you are a genetic counselor, phone a friend. There's GCs that work at companies. There's GCs that work at insurance. And ultimately, at the end of the day, we're trying to get testing for the patients that need it. So don't hesitate to reach out to folks.
If you are a certified genetic counselor and would like to come on GenotypeCast to talk about an issue related to genetics in the news, send an email to podcast@graygenetics.com.
The information contained in this podcast does not constitute medical advice and is also not a substitute for genetic counseling. Neither Gray Genetics nor any of its guests makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the statements or any information contained in this podcast. Evaluation of an individual's personal and family health history is a crucial part of genetic counseling and any recommendations.